necessarily unsafe, but like your example with your friend who's Christian, if they're less educated, then it sort of becomes this hierarchy that can be alienating. Yeah.
Yeah, my friend and I were actually just talking about this because as all young, white, aspiring activists as the age of 13, you know, I had a lot of poetry about, like, oh, this world, we just need to, like, hold hands and everything's going to change and, you know, like, I'm going to wear recycled clothing. And it's just like, you know, back in that time, it's like I really just did not know so many things, like, for real. And it's like, but I was given the space to make those mistakes, you know, and I feel like that was valuable to me because I think if I had been, like, shut off entirely and people, like, had told me, like, like, oh, what you're doing is actually perpetuating, like, this white savior thing, and it's really toxic and dangerous, and you're literally murdering people. I'd be like, no, what? I'm 13, please. Like, you know, and I'd never do poetry again. Or maybe I would, but at least knowing my 13-year-old self, like, I was not good as a 13-year-old. So I think that there is a lot to be said about, like, letting people make mistakes and then being like, oh, okay, this is now your moment that I'm going to empower you to become an ally. And, like, it's cool that you know, you're trying and you're probably coming from the right place, or maybe you're living in this privileged forest and you've never seen this before. But now, you know, here's my kind of opportunity that I'm giving to you to change your perspective. And that's actually something my friend Jamie and I were talking about the other day. So she kind of got me thinking about that. I think it's actually a really interesting way of looking at it, because I think that, you know, something that people say is a problem with call-out culture is, like, this alienation. Like, you know, the fact that people feel like they can't, you know, they have to be politically correct, quote-unquote, and then somebody's going to, you know, banish them off to the streets and, like, they're never going to return to this community. And it's also, you know, they become canceled or whatever. And I think that, you know, that's really just, like, not an effective way to go about it.
You just heard Schmooze Fest. Thanks for listening.
If any of the organizations that some of our panelists touched on really sort of drew your interest, you can head to citr.ca and find the recording of this episode under recent episodes. And we've got some links there to some of these organizations, Redgate Art Society, UBC Slam, the Artivism that happened just a couple weeks ago. We've also got links to Binner's Project, Out on Screen, Out in Schools, the Wet Ink Collective. They've got some really cool stuff happening in March, so keep an eye out for that. Also links to Angelica Poversky's YouTube channel and their TED Talk on Goggle Images, and the link to Shameless Hussy Productions. All of these organizations are still doing some fantastic work, so definitely check out what they've got going on. And thank you so much for joining us. We are glad that you could be with us and hope that you learned a lot.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Nisiyam, Nisiyaya, Thikum Queen Ansep, Hydra Siyam, Nisiyam, Nisiyaya,
Anthasyakhuya, Talitin, Homasqueam, Mustayo. Good morning and welcome to everyone tuning in. I am your host, Giselle Gettig, and this is the Global Get Down, a bi-weekly podcast by the International Relations Student Association exploring a range of topics affiliated with global affairs. In collaboration with CITR's 24 Hours of Student Power this week, we have prepared a preview of the first IR Voices segment, highlighting student initiatives and stories. In this episode, I am joined by Haley Dash, an undergraduate student at UBC in her fifth and final year specializing in international relations and social justice. She is the co-founder of Asilu Collective, which is an anti-racist feminist group working to abolish police presence in Ottawa schools. Welcome to the show, Haley.
Thanks, Giselle. I'm happy to be here to talk about the work I'm doing and in the comfort of your room.
Yeah, it's nice to be able to record this episode within our household because we're in the same bubble and...
Yeah, very COVID-friendly, and I get to wear my house slippers in your rocking chair.
Cozy and COVID-friendly.
Yes.
And we would also like to acknowledge that this episode was recorded on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territory of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh First Nations. All right, so let's get started by taking it back to how you embarked on this journey. What resulted in you pursuing this collective and your initiatives?
Yeah, so earlier this year, around April, May, there was a lot of growing support for defunding and demilitarizing the police, both locally in my hometown of Ottawa, where we're doing this work, and globally. Obviously, we see the protests across the US, Europe, of course, Canada, and the rest of the world, especially with the Black Lives Matter movement. And so two friends and I from high school, we all graduated from the same high school in 2016. We saw that no group in Ottawa was undertaking the work specifically around policing in schools. So we decided that we would undertake this campaign as we knew we could dedicate all our time and energy to this well into the future. And it was also a personal issue for all of us, myself being South Asian and the two other co-founders of the Silu Collective being Black. We've seen our communities and other marginalized and impoverished communities being over-policed historically. So this was something really important to us. So we started a petition. It garnered hundreds of signatures from the Ottawa community, just calling on the school boards to remove cops from schools. And along with that, dozens of people submitted personal stories and feelings towards this issue. So policing in schools is really, really key to policing in general and, you know, carceral systems in Canada, especially considering the school-to-prison pipeline. And it just allows this kind of environment of policing to be sustained and allow Black, Indigenous, and other marginalized communities to continue to exist under a violent oppression from a very, very young age. So it's very dangerous.
Yeah, thanks for sharing your personal experiences and how you came about finding a Silu Collective. But you mentioned the school-to-prison pipeline. For listeners that might not know what that concept means, could you talk a little bit more about it?
Yeah, definitely. So the school-to-prison pipeline essentially is the over-policing of racialized and other marginalized youth. So this could be like low-income, drug-using, disabled, and of course Black, Indigenous, Muslim youth. And so they're over-policing in both in their schools and on school property as well as in their neighborhoods, results in the over-representation of these children in carceral facilities. So this starts off as youth detention centers and then transitions into prisons.
So it's like the very nature of the name itself. It takes these kids out of their school and puts them into prisons.
Yeah, exactly. And it's happening because of their differences, most often their racial differences. And this is really evident in Ontario, where I'm from, because of the extreme overrepresentation of racialized youth, especially Black and Indigenous boys and girls in youth detention centers. Like Black and Indigenous boys are 4 to 5 times more likely to be in these centers compared to their white counterparts. And then Indigenous girls are actually 10 times more likely than their white counterparts and peers to be in these detention centers.
Yeah, those numbers are staggering to hear, and it's quite a daunting statistic
too. Yeah, it's very, very alarming. And so something else that's really important to the school-to-prison pipeline is not only police are taking part in this, but policing can also be perpetuated and acted by teaching administration through kind of like a zero tolerance approach. So in Ontario, for example, this is enacted provincially through the Safe Schools Act from 2001. And so these kids are targeted not only by cops, but also the teaching administration who patrol their halls, and they view the behavior of racialized children as adultified, meaning that it's instead of being seen as typical teenage behavior, they're now seen as criminals. And what they're doing is seen as criminal activity. And so from a very young age, these children are met with police violence, and they're interrogated, accosted, arrested at school because of this, in their neighborhoods because of this. And so it sets them up for a lifetime of policing. And the work we're doing on the school to prison pipeline is in high schools, which is where most of the police presence is across Canada. But this also happens when the teaching administration is involved. They'll call police officers to elementary schools and to handle younger children. And so, like, we saw a few months ago, I think it was in May, in Peel, which is right outside mm-hmm. of Toronto, a six-year-old black girl, she was, like, handcuffed and restrained on the ground by multiple police officers because the teaching administration called them to do so.
That's 6 years old, and this was just a few months ago.
Yeah.
It's these stories you share and you hear, it just continues to emphasize how bad this issue is getting despite everything we're doing.
Yeah, definitely. And it's, like, important to talk about this in the Canadian context, just because in the news we usually see and talk about the U.S.
Right.
So I think it's really important for Canadians to bring it back home and understand this is definitely a Canadian issue as well.
Yeah, I, in fact, went to high school in the state of New York,
right.
and we saw a lot of police often come onto campus to do their checkups, and they would often marginalize the black boys on our campus.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that you're saying this is happening in Canada, which isn't often highlighted as much, to six-year-olds or just kids that have barely finished kindergarten, it just goes to show how deeply rooted the police presence has become in marginalized youth lives.
Yeah, for sure. And it's, like, happening before these kids are even exposed to the idea of racism and what racism is sometimes.
Right. So how is policing in schools related to other movements that also center policing, such as the Black Lives Matter or the ANSARS movement in Nigeria?
Yeah, that's a good question. Kind of like what I hinted at just a minute ago, is that we need to conceptualize policing as, like, a larger institution of punishment and surveillance that's not only enacted by police, but also people like I mentioned, teaching administration, you know, social workers can do this, the military, you know, and other surveillance apparatuses across the world. So children in schools are exposed to police violence because the school administration believes punishment is an effective means to control their behavior or even controlling their behavior. Particularly non-normative behavior, what we don't think is normal, in general, is a form of policing. So it's not just from cops. It's just essentially the enforcement of a set of rules by anyone who is able to, like, systemically ensure the disenfranchisement of marginalized communities. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned SARS. We can see how, in Nigeria,
mm-hmm.
SARS is a colonial police force, so the UK funds and trains them, and they've discussed this openly, so
has admitted to this.
Yes, exactly. So this isn't some conspiracy theory. This is truthful and historically accurate. So they are a colonial police force, and they are backed by Western powers, and they're upholding their interests
right.
in Nigeria. Again, we're seeing this, like, controlling of black populations. So our campaign to remove police presence from schools is totally connected with these movements inherently, because we're addressing larger systems of oppression through kind of, like, abolitionist principles, because we are an abolitionist collective, just kind of like Black Lives Matter chapters across the world. So we're kind of envisioning a world, hopefully in our lifetime, where cops don't have to exist. They don't exist. Neither do prisons. The military, CSIS, RCMP, child welfare system in Canada, you know, these are all forms of surveillance, policing, punishment.
Right. And so you bring up this concept of a SILU being an abolitionist collective. And even to this day, there's this increase in demand to change to policing. And often discussions have revolved more around reform and defunding, but not necessarily abolition, as you
mm-hmm.
have mentioned previously. Would you like to elaborate on what your abolitionist work entails and how that actually differs from the more common threads of demanding reform and defunding within police departments?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because I think a lot of these terms are getting, like, thrown around without really understanding
right.
where they're rooted in or what they actually mean. So, like, first, let's, like, think about defunding. Like, this was initially conceptualized as the primary step towards abolition. And so I think everyone understands that it is a reallocation of funds to services that are underfunded or they don't exist right now. So, like, childcare, housing, food security, harm reduction facilities, alternatives to police response, right? And so the absence of these services severely impacts marginalized communities. And then with the reallocation of these funds, policing would become obsolete. So defunding does mean defunding the police into abolition, right? But like you said, I feel like defunding recently kind of has been co-opted by reformist movements to symbolize a slight decrease in police funds, but wherein the police, essentially, they still exist. Right. So it's defunding them a little bit, but not, but they still exist and they're still policing.
They're still around. They're still within the communities.
Exactly. And we see this a lot with kind of this police reform into community policing, which is the police trying to rebrand as, you know, oh, we're going to, like, relate to your communities and we're going to put racialized police officers into your communities so that we can understand you better. It's like a one-on-one relationship. Again, this is just, like, more intimate form of surveillance.
Right. The other day, I remember coming out to the living room and telling you guys I saw a van passing by and it said Vancouver Community Surveillance or something like that. And I had to ask, was that the police or was that something that's new? But it was just the police rebranded.
Yeah, exactly. It's still the VPD. It's rebranding, exactly. So people imagine that this would solve problems such as police brutality, which is, like, fueled by racism, of course, but that's impossible. Like, none of this rebranding or co-option of reform or defunding is able to eliminating racism or brutality, because policing in itself is racist. And we can go back to thinking about, like, the establishment of the RCMP in Canada, and it was established to eliminate Indigenous peoples from their land by colonizers. To this day, the RCMP aids the ongoing genocide that's occurring with Indigenous peoples, a genocide that even Trudeau acknowledged last year. And so you can't reform this. It's impossible. Or we can think of local police forces and, like, VPD or Ottawa Police Services. And they emerged out of slave patrols in Canada. I know we Canadians often forget that there was slavery in Canada, but enslaved Africans in Canada, they were patrolled by local police authorities called slave patrols. And then this is how entities like VPD, OPS, Toronto Police Services, they came to be. And this is history. It's a fact. So you can't reform something that was created for genocide or enslavement, because racism is intrinsic to its existence.
So at the start of this conversation, you mentioned that your campaign to remove SROs in Ottawa began with a petition which garnered support from hundreds of people, and you mentioned dozens of people sharing their personal stories. Would you mind sharing a brief overview of trends and patterns that seem to occur to marginalized students when they came in contact with SROs that you might have particularly seen through the personal stories that were shared?
Yeah, definitely. So when we've received these stories, we're looking at the short-term and long-term impacts on these youth. So this is, like, physical, psychological, emotional violence that they're enduring. So a lot of the time we see that this has a direct exposure to this violence, whether it be, like, emotional or physical. The kids understand why this is happening, and so this is really impacting their self-esteem. They understand they're being labeled because of their race, and they are being targeted not only as individuals but as a community, and they know how their white peers are treated in contrast. So they see this, it's impacting their self-esteem, their trust with not just cops or teaching administration, but just authoritative figures. Something else that we've seen is that a lot of these kids are saying that they already see police in their neighborhoods very frequently. So police presence is actually something that never leaves their lives, because when they leave their home, they walk to school, they bus to school, whatever, and then they arrive, and then there's more cops. And the SRO program is quite unique because it actually allows police officers to follow kids home and deal with so-called school-related issues outside of the school. And so police officers under the SRO program are allowed to speak to these minors without parental supervision and whatnot. And so a lot of these kids have said that they just can't, they can't escape it. Something else that really stood out was the police involvement, police-involved suspensions for Black and brown youth. It's often boys whose dress code is heavily policed, right, and it's policed by police officers and administration, because anything that they wear, especially Black youth, is seen as gang affiliated. So like do-rags or bandanas, and these kids are just trying to go to school and look good. Like, these, yeah, are accessories for them, but they are seen as criminals as soon as they wear this. And so it's their culture that's being seen as criminal, and also their Blackness as well.
Yeah, so you mentioned these young boys and heavy policing on the dress code. Mm-hmm. What were trends and complaints you saw among girls, especially since earlier you mentioned Indigenous girls were 10 times more likely to be incarcerated than their peers? So is there an example or anything you've heard from girls' experiences?
Yeah, definitely. In terms of girls, we got a lot of, this was something that that wasn't necessarily on my radar when we, mm-hmm, first started doing this research and this outreach with youth and our campaign when it began. But police a lot of the time are called to investigate sexual harassment and assault complaints from girls. So when high school girls are going to administration about something like this, mm-hmm, a lot of the time they call in cops to deal with this, which of course is very problematic. And so what happens is these police officers will, you know, so-called interview these young girls, and they, these girls have raised concerns, explaining that police officers have slut-shamed them. They're trying to poke holes in their stories, delegitimizing their stories through that. Victim blaming is something that came up a lot. And so a lot of the time, these young girls, it might be their first exposure to sexual violence. And so it also is their first exposure to any kind of help that is supposedly there for them. And then they see that actually there is no support from these, you know, police officials that are so, like, apparently there to help them.
Right. And yeah, thank you for sharing that. That's obviously something that's not easy to hear, especially in the early morning,
yeah,
times. And it's just such a daunting reality to live in. And it's very interesting that you said that the girls' trends about slut shaming and poking holes in their story kind of emerged through your research. And like, while we might have been aware of it, you weren't expecting it to be the first thing to kind of pop up.
Yeah, and also like after looking more into this issue and seeing this trend of, mm-hmm, young girls dealing with assault and harassment claims with officers, we see like why this is happening is a lot of these racialized girls are, like I said, I used the word adultified earlier, but they're also sexualized. Mm-hmm. And the reason they're being slut-shamed and victim-blamed is because they are racialized, they are Black, they're Indigenous, they're brown, they're seen as hypersexual and hyperactive, and, you know, they're bringing this upon themselves, you know, because their race inherently makes them this way.
Right.
And it makes them hypersexual, which, of course, is not the case. And it is simply because they're racialized that they're seen this way.
Right. Well, yeah, so your collective's done a lot of research, clearly, from collecting personal stories to your petitions. And how has your team gone on to conduct... Sorry about that. How has your team gone on to conduct research to further your campaign?
Yeah, so like we already talked about, like, we're collecting stories through youth outreach and our petition form and other means to get stories from students who are willing to share their experiences. And so we've been doing that, which, again, collecting anecdotes. And these aren't just from students. It's also educators or people who work within the education system. So this could also be guidance counselors, and we are like therapists and other people who are in the school system who mm-hmm. deal with students and who like witness all of this, and they a lot of the time are saying that students don't want to work with police officers, and that redirecting them from teaching admin to police officers can be really harmful. We have parents saying the exact same thing,
right.
that their children don't feel comfortable with police presence, for the same reasons that the students are saying, and other communities in Ottawa who understand how this is really harmful, and they're just general perceptions of police presence. And so we're kind of coding this data based on which school board they're affiliated with, what themes are present, if they mention their race or their gender, we like take that into consideration. And then we're also doing kind of external research when we're examining published documents and reports and research from Ontario, like especially Toronto or other parts of Canada. We've taken a look at data from Nova Scotia, and this all revolves around policing in schools. So we're looking at the Safe Schools Act, which is from Ontario. It makes police presence in schools mandatory in every Ontario school. And we're just kind of looking at our findings. And of course, they are concluding that student safety and barrier-free education is only ensured through the removal of cops.
How can listeners access this data once it becomes available?
So we're actually releasing a report that compiles all of this and just kind of synthesizes it in like a legible way for readers, and we're going to be releasing that in coming weeks, and so they can subscribe to our mailing list.
Mm-hmm.
So we send frequent updates, or they can look on our social media. Again, we put frequent updates, and all of that is at ASILU Collective, or our website is asilucollective.ca, so that's asilucollective.ca, where you can subscribe to our mailing list for updates, and then we're going to post the report there as well, of course, and then Instagram and Twitter are at ASILU Collective, so we'll also post updates about our report there, where you can take a look at all our research that's being conducted.
Listeners can also find the petition on your website, and if
yes.
they would like to sign it, they can go ahead and do that.
Yes, and we also host events and workshops and things like that all around like the policing and carceral systems, so you can always get involved. Again, just we're always updating social media and our website to relay that information to you all.
Do you have any other collaborations or projects that you're working on or have worked on?
Yeah, so myself and ASILU's other two co-founders, we've spoken on a number of panels and rallies as well about policing in recent months. So folks have attended this live, both in person and virtually because of COVID. And a lot of them have been interactive, so that's always really great. So people can ask questions, and you know, we can have brainstorming sessions about like what's next. And these are all recorded. Oftentimes and put onto our social media, so if you can't make it live, you can watch it later. And yeah, we have lots planned for upcoming weeks in terms of direct action, which folks can participate in virtually and on the ground. So stay tuned. And the most recent thing that we have come up with is a student workshop,
mm-hmm.
A training workshop. So we're going to be talking to Ottawa high schoolers. This is on December 3rd. We're going to be talking to them about direct action,
mm-hmm.
how they can enact change and use their power as students, and knowing your protesting rights and using their student leadership skills, etc. So that's something that people might be interested in taking a look at.
So, to wrap it up, what does the future of ASILU Collective look like for you?
It looks like getting cops out of schools as soon as possible so that children and youth have equal access to education that's free from violence.
Preferably in our lifetime.
Yes, preferably in the next few months, actually, as soon as possible.
And how can other students interested in making change get involved in student activism? Or do you have any specific advice you can provide for Vancouver listeners?
Yes, so I would say find a local organization or group that speaks to you. The UBC and Vancouver community has lots, including Vancouver's very own No Cops in School campaign. They have an Instagram. I think it's just No Cops in School.
So they're doing really great work. There's Climate Justice UBC, UBC Social Justice Center, Black Lives Matter Vancouver, New Z Collective is also really great. So reach out to them, ask how you can help. And if you don't have time to commit yourself to this work with them, you should redistribute your money to these orgs or similar orgs or Indigenous movements whose land you occupy. That's always very important because this is unpaid work and these people are just doing it because it's out of survival for their communities. So money is very important in these times, especially.
Right. And if people have listened throughout the whole episode today, you can also see how you can conduct your own research and create your collectives like Haley and find things that might not be happening in your community that needs to change, that you can use how you can listen to how she has conducted her research mm-hmm. and go ahead and create something of your own if you have even more time.
Yeah, and if you folks are planning on doing that or thinking about doing that, if you want to fill a gap in the activist work in your community, I think it's really important to ally yourself with local organizations who are experienced organizers, who know what they're doing, and it's really helpful to do that and create a coalition of movements.
Right. Thank you for sharing that as well. And how can listeners support ASILU specifically and your mission or get involved with the ASILU Collective?
I've plugged our social media already, so I'll say it again, at ASILU Collective on Instagram and Twitter, ASILU. We also have a website, asilucollective.ca. So you can take a look at upcoming events. Our toolkit is all there, so this is a really easy way to contact elected school board officials about the issue of police presence in schools. So we have email scripts and mm-hmm. phone scripts, templates, sample tweets, and like who you should be tagging. And so it makes it really easy and accessible to do so. And if you want to get really involved, you can contact us via DM on Instagram or Twitter, or you can send us an email, which is asilucollective@gmail.com. Again, it's asilucollective@gmail.com. And you can reach out to us there about something you'd like to specifically work on with us.
Thank you, Haley, for joining me on this episode of The Global Get Down.
Thank you for having me in your room. This was fun.
It really was. It was also nice to see dogs passing by
yeah.
through the window. Yes. Especially when the topic is quite heavy to go through.
Mm-hmm.
And thank you to everyone who tuned in this morning. For our new listeners, don't forget, The Global Get Down has multiple episodes available on our Spotify and YouTube channel, including our most recently released episode, which looks at change in Chile as their constitution is under scrutiny by the public. Stay updated on future Global Get Down episodes by following the International Relations Student Association on Facebook or Instagram at IRSAUBC. Today's recorded episode will also be made available to stream again as our mid-season finale on December 8th. Have a wonderful day.
Without the help and support of our friends, we here at CITR wouldn't be able to bring you all the great music, art, cinema, and culture that you love. Thanks to the long-standing support from the Rio Theater, we are able to keep you informed on all the great artists, films, and everything else coming to town there. For all the current information about who and what's playing at the Rio Theater, visit their website at www.riotheater.ca.
Red Cat Records is an amazing artist-owned and operated record store. Shop from their diverse online music collection and get free shipping within Vancouver and the Lower Mainland with the purchase of two or more LPs. If you would like to further support them through the evolving COVID-19 crisis, you can do so by buying a gift card to use at a later date. Visit www.redcat.ca for more information.
In the
context of Vancouver's opioid crisis, CITR would like to take a moment to share some harm reduction strategies.
Try not to do drugs alone. When going out, let friends know what drugs you're taking and make sure someone has a naloxone kit. If you're able to, get your drugs tested before taking them.
Avoid mixing opioids with alcohol or stimulants. Remember that opioids can include painkillers prescribed by a doctor, and it's possible for any drugs to be contaminated with opioids.
Learn the signs of opioid overdose, which include, but are not limited to, unresponsiveness or unconsciousness, inability to speak, breathing that is slow, erratic, or has stopped completely, heartbeat that is slow, erratic, or has stopped completely, skin tone that has turned blue or gray, choking or gurgling sounds.
If you think someone is overdosing, call 911 immediately. Start rescue breathing and administer naloxone if you have it. You cannot get in trouble for being on drugs, so always call 911 in an emergency.
For more information about naloxone kits and training, visit towardtheheart.com.
Thank you and stay safe.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded, Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Welcome back. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the traditional and unceded territories of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. This is 24 hours of student power, and you just heard an absolutely wonderful podcast produced by the International Relations Student Association talking about police violence and surveillance in Canada, which is a topic that is not addressed enough in our conversations about police violence, which often emphasized the United States. They were talking about the school-to-prison pipeline, the relationship between racialization and racism and victim blaming, and all of the movements, the radical movements to abolish the police. I really appreciated hearing this podcast, and I especially appreciated hearing about the work that these fantastic members of the UBC community are doing. And I'm grateful that you took the time to listen in as well.
To prevent the spread of coronavirus 2019, or COVID-19, social distancing and self-isolation measures have been recommended. Here are some tips for managing your mental health while working from home, in self-isolation, quarantined, having to be home due to loss of employment, or just having to be home more than usual, according to @counselingforallseasons on Instagram. Try to create a structure or routine for your day. Structure helps us feel a sense of normalcy and control, and this is especially important during a time with a lot of unknowns. Routines do not have to be about productivity. Take a nap, go for a walk, or read a book. Remember to have regular meals and hydrate. This can add to a regular routine, and both of these can contribute to mood changes. If it's possible, get outside. If it's possible, get outside or open your windows. Fresh air and natural light can be beneficial to mental health. Don't be afraid to go outside. Just make sure you're observing basic social distancing. Stick to a sleep routine. Both lack of sleep and excess sleep can increase anxiety and depression. Keep up with personal hygiene and chores. Skipping personal hygiene routines can affect our moods, so try to shower, etc., even though you're not going out. Keeping your space tidy and clean can help with mental health, but it'll also contribute to preventing the spread of COVID-19. It's two birds, one stone. Remember to connect with loved ones. We might not be able to see people face to face, but that doesn't mean that those relationships are any less meaningful or important. Connection is vital to our mental health, especially in times that can feel full of despair.
My name is Catherine Keir Chambers, and I am the current president of CITR and a Squatters student executive. For the rest of this hour, we're going to play you a bit of music handpicked by CITR's student executive. We're starting off with a song written and composed and performed by a member of CITR's own student community,
of former exec member Sarah Carbone. Her song is called April Sun. And following that, you will hear two songs by the band Tiger Really. First is a song with an absolutely killer title. Excuse me, I think there's tears in my Slurpee. And following that is the song Colorblinded, also by Tiger Really. I hope that you enjoy, and again, I'm grateful that you have listened to this conversation this morning. I hope that you have learned a lot. I hope that it's given you a chance for reflection. Again, this is 24 hours of student power, emphasizing student empowerment, community, and social justice. Thank you for joining us.
try to talk to me. I'm just trying to think it through. And if you see me fall apart at 7-Eleven after dark, maybe don't look at me and don't let it bother you. But if you really, really wanna stay, then just hold my hand and walk away. Don't leave me here with nothing but soggy light blue ice drinks. And tell me, baby, it's okay to just be you. This will slowly freeze my hands, but I don't think you understand. I do this every week, and this is nothing.
TransCare BC works to enhance the coordination of trans health services across the province and offer expanded health services to support transgender communities. They are doing this by developing gender-affirming client-centered models of service, ensuring access to gender-affirming and supportive healthcare that is equitable and available, and supporting network development to make sure trans and gender-diverse individuals, their families, and healthcare providers have access to information, resources, and support. Check out phsa.ca to learn more about this program and lend your voice to help create an inclusive and supportive system for trans members of our community.
Crimes and Treasons Radio, this is Riff Raff. Every Tuesday from 9 to 11 p.m. on 101.9 FM.
Yes, yes, you and I rock with the best, 101.9 CITR Radio. Crimes and Treasons, this is your boy Just Blaze. Right now you're rocking with Jules Andre Brown, Rolly Rails, Jamal Steels, and Horsepower. You know what it is, all right?
Yo, it's Iron Sue, man. I want to shout out Crimes and Treasons Radio, man. CITR 101.9, man. Turn up, turn up, turn up.
We don't need to tell you that Vancouver has a housing problem.
Mass evictions.
Mass rent evictions.
Unfair rent increases.
What happened to rent control and protection from unfair eviction?
If these or other housing matters concern you, you may be interested in joining the Vancouver Tenants Union. For more information, visit tenantsunion.ca.
You're listening to CITR 101.9. Broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Welcome back to 24 Hours of Student Power. My name is Catherine Gear Chambers, the current president of CITR Student Executive. I'm really excited that you're joining us for our programming today. You just heard three songs by members of the UBC student community. First was April Sun by Sarah Carbone, followed by two songs by Tiger Reilly. First, I Think There Are Tears in My Slurpee, which has got to be my favorite song title of the year, followed by their song, Colorblinded. 24 Hours, in case you have not heard of this program or are just tuning in, 24 Hours of Student Power is an annual broadcasting event that celebrates the fantastic work and art coming out of the UBC student community and the community at large. This past hour, there was a podcast produced by the International Relations Student Association, in which two members of the community talked about police violence in Canada, specifically surveillance in schools, the school-to-prison pipeline, and the relationship between surveillance in communities and ongoing police violence. They also touching on the extremely racist history of policing in general and promoting and informing the community about ways to counter this violence, about activist organizations and movements to defund the police with the goal of abolishing policing altogether. The next hour that you'll hear, somewhat along the same lines, is a conversation that I had last week with Ishmam and Gabby, two members of the UBC Social Justice Center, who talked to me about issues that Vancouver is facing, such as the housing crisis, who also talked about the movement to defund the police in Vancouver especially. They gave a detailed and informative update about what's happening there and suggested some action items that you can take. They talked about the criminalization of poverty, media representation of this crisis, and then our conversation turns towards activism on campus, what it means to be an activist when part of a university community and the UBC community in general, and what the university's role is in social justice or in and or in upholding systems of violence and of oppression. I hope that you stick around for that conversation, and I am extremely glad that you are joining us right now. Before we end this hour, we'll play you off with another song. The artist's name is Mode Wakes. The song is Modern Replica. The album is Exist. I hope that you enjoy. Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us.